I read it from a reputable green team site. This is from theCelticsBlog.com, right, Murray?
Correct.
Okay. Bobby Manning wrote this the other day, and it was just a survey of the players that came out of the third lottery position. Not the third pick, but the teams that started with the third lottery position and what happened. He said,
This is Cousin Anthony. Welcome to the Bobcast.
I'm going to bomb this.
So that's where I got it from, Dave, just by the way.
Welcome back to the Bobcast, a weekly tour. We're doing this daily now, almost daily. We're releasing 3-4 of these a week. Usually we do this over Skype. We'll have people on over the internet, but for the first time ever, and our guest today should feel pretty good about this, we are having an in-person recording of this, the Bobcast. We got drinks around here. We're feeling good on a Friday night. And we are talking jazz, music, politics. We hit it all on this show, and that's exactly what we're going to do today with our guest, a longtime friend of mine, and someone who has just been overdue to be on this show. So much to talk about with him, and we're going to get to it. We're going to give him the good Bobcast intro. My guest today is a world-renowned guitar player. He has won awards for jazz in various competitions. I can't even count them off. He could recite them, I'm sure, but we're not going to get into the particulars of that. I want to get into his journey today, because you know, here on the Bobcast, we talk about people going from aspiration to accomplishment, and he has definitely done that. Jazz guitarist Theo Curtin, who I went to high school with. We both go to college out in New York. He goes to school out at Ithaca, while I'm at Syracuse, about an hour away. He is our guest here today on the Bobcast. Welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here. That was a crazy introduction right there.
A lot of people love the introductions. We're going to go to the next step. Day one. My first question for you is, your dad played saxophone, piano, very big jazz enthusiast in his own right. What drew you towards the guitar?
Towards the guitar? Well, that was definitely the Beatles. My dad, he was playing all sorts of music, like, around the house when I grew up. So I guess I just, I got an ear for all sorts of different genres and styles of music. But, yeah, when I heard the Beatles, that's really when I wanted to play the guitar.
Now, was he a record kind of guy? Did he have CDs going? Was it just always music going throughout the house?
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, it was probably, what, VHS? We got to have a CD. No, not VHS, the, what are those things called?
The cassettes, yeah. Right when we were born in about 98, the cassettes were just entering their prime, and then they very quickly fizzled out. So that's what was going for you, and then eventually you go through CDs, and now today it's all about the streaming. Has your dad started streaming music yet?
No, he's old-fashioned, he buys the CDs.
I've grown to love the vinyls. That's been a big thing for me. Yeah. The crisp sound, having like the big physical album.
It's because you're a hipster.
Yeah. I'm going in that direction with the beard and everything.
Oh, yeah.
What eventually led you to pick up the guitar? Was it? Did you get into lessons? Was it school? Was it our music teacher, Mr. Leventhal?
I saw him a couple weeks ago at the gym. He's doing good.
So, yeah, about what grade do you think you started playing guitar?
I think it was fourth grade. Because I remember in fifth grade, I played in, like, the graduation ceremony.
Yeah.
Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. So I was probably playing for, like, a year then.
So that was just your second year playing guitar that you did What a Wonderful World in the graduation ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad, he didn't play guitar or anything, but he understands, like, music theory very well. And so he, like, figured out enough guitar to teach me. And then eventually I got some lessons at the YMCA, and then I got, like, a private teacher.
Do you remember the first time you picked up guitar? Like, picked up a physical guitar?
Yeah, my dad actually, how I got my first guitar, he surprised me. For my birthday, he drove me to a music store and just had me play different guitars, because I was super into the Beatles, as I said at the time, and I just, like, wanted to be John Lennon, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then I got a little tiny acoustic that I still have.
So I know your teacher was a big part of your upbringing once you actually started taking lessons to, you know, advance your skills. What were some of the biggest things that he passed on to you?
Oh, man, I mean, everything. I mean, he's one of the best musicians I've ever met. He's a master on the guitar. Every style he has just mastered. So I mean, he taught me so much. Ed O'Brien.
Ed O'Brien.
If anyone wants to take guitar lessons, go to Ed O'Brien and Lynn. He is extremely knowledgeable.
Was he a friend of your dad's or something? Is that how you?
No, we just found him out of the blue, and it was great. Like, you could not ask for a more knowledgeable guy. Super nice guy too.
What were some of the first lessons like with him?
I remember my first lesson. I forget what we talked about, but I just had that little acoustic, and it was cheap, so it didn't stay in tune well. And I put it back in the bag, in the little case, and I brought it home, and like, I tried to. It had become like untuned, and I tried to like show like something from my dad that he taught me. My dad's like what the hell? Like, he tuned in one of those crazy hippie tunings. So yeah, but then my dad met him, and like, they saw how much he knew about music and what a great guitar player he was.
He approved.
Oh yeah.
So the Beatles were obviously such a big inspiration for you. What was it about them that really struck out to you? I know like they're just such renowned as songwriters, but you really gravitated towards like the guitar playing aspect of them, even though like I would think of songwriting as like being the number one thing that would like strike you about them, like Paul McCartney. Like, so many people who love the Beatles are big Paul McCartney guys, but you gravitated towards John Lennon, right?
Well, they're both great songwriters.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. I don't know what struck me about it. I mean, it must have been the songwriting even then, but I wasn't thinking that. Like, I just loved the music,
yeah.
And I couldn't, like, intellectualize it like I can now. So it's hard to say, but I remember my dad played Please Please Me for me, and I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world, and I just wanted to be John Lennon.
Yeah. So there was just, it was always, like, a culture of, like, music just going through your house.
Yeah, I mean, not only music, my dad especially has a lot of interest, so. It was a lot of stuff, but yeah, he was definitely always playing music.
Who were some of your other inspirations musically?
Well, before I got into the Beatles, actually, my dad was always playing Frank Sinatra, and so I always heard that music. And that's not jazz, but it's like a pop music that has a lot of jazz elements. You know, like he has records with the Count Basie Orchestra, stuff like that. Like, there'll be like jazz improvisers like in the tracks, but it's pop music, but it's very well arranged. And so I just like, when I was very young, when I heard all that, and I just, it's very catchy, so I liked it, and now I can. So I guess I've always heard stuff with strong jazz elements even before I could appreciate like true like jazz.
Mm-hmm. And we're gonna talk about the wide-reaching influence of jazz in particular later in the show. I do want to talk about the time. It doesn't seem like there was a moment in particular where you transitioned from rock to jazz, but do you remember the period where rock just seemed to start to bore you a little bit musically? It seemed like that was like a big reason that you started taking on the challenge of jazz. You know, I know your dad was a big jazz fan, but what made you want to like take that leap into that harder musical form?
Well, yeah, it wasn't like one day I woke up and was like, I'm a jazz. It was a progression. Well, I mean, as I started getting better on the guitar, like learned all the chords, learned some riffs, could play like, you know, the classic rock, like riffs from Led Zeppelin and all that other stuff. The next step is like soloing. Like, all those guys on all those records could improvise a solo, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that was the next step. And then I started being able to improvise. Once you take that leap, you actually have to understand music theory at some level, or even if you can't articulate, you have to like have a good enough ear. You can find it on your instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really when I guess I progressed. And like, first I was just a rock, like I was like, I would play blues stuff, like my heroes were Eric Clapton, B.B. King, Alt Hendrix, all those guys.
Yep.
And then I just kept playing, improvising on guitar, and I was just drawn towards the faster guys who would play like more notes and more technical stuff. And I started getting into like progressive rock bands like Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Yeah.
And they're still rock. They have vocals, but they have like strong classical and jazz influences.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard the fusion bands in the 70s, like Weather Report, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, and what Chicory was doing. And that's, a lot of it was instrumental, but it, so it was jazz and had improvised solos, but it had like rock instrumentation, electric guitar, and stuff like that, so I could still relate to it in a way. And after I started playing that stuff and heard, opened up to that jazz, like full straight ahead jazz was an easy next step.
It seems like through listening, that's what sort of drew you deeper and deeper into the genre. Was it like just nonstop listening? Yeah.
I say I grew up hearing jazz, which is true, but I definitely didn't like most jazz. I liked jazzy, like Frank Sinatra stuff with the vocals. But I remember when I would drive around in the car with my dad, and he'd put on jazz. It would sound boring. It would sound like nothing. And so like, even then, I would...
We're recording!
Where's your friend?
Well, they're up here, too.
Okay.
For me, as a more of a newer jazz listener within the last year or so, there's definitely an adjustment curve getting into the music, just throwing it on and hearing and trying to identify different particular aspects of the genre as a whole. I wonder... As someone who plays it, was there an adjustment curve playing it as there is for listening to it, like you talked about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, being a jazz is incredibly hard to learn, and it took me a while to even understand any of it. But in terms of listening, like I said, I remember when my dad would play straight ahead jazz in the car, like, I didn't know what it was then, but it was probably still Miles Davis. Like, he's a huge Charlie Parker fan. I mean, just hearing that, it makes no sense. Like, it's the reason people aren't interested in it is because it's not something you can just, that's easily accessible. It's almost, I mean, it depends on what kind of jazz you're talking about, because there's, like, the earlier stuff, like the stuff in the 30s and 20s is pretty accessible. Like, but, like, when it started becoming more of an intellectual genre instead of for popularity, it didn't have, like, a general audience, and the only people who would continue to listen were like people who knew a lot about music or like were good jazz musicians themselves. Mm-hmm. Pretty much that's the audience for jazz today. It's jazz musicians.
Yeah.
It's a very small group. Cause I don't know. It just, jazz is always about, was always about innovation. And the guy who could do the new ideas, like that's the direction it would go in. And so it evolved so quickly and it became so intellectual so fast. It just lost all its mass appeal, and it was just too much for like the general population. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think there is an audience for jazz, but it is so small because I feel like the hardcore music listeners who do want to challenge themselves and dive deeper into stuff like that, like a guy like Kamasi Washington nowadays has really drawn people in, but it's more
outside jazz circles, you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's the people who are so into music who are drawn towards record stores. And you see, I went to a record store in New York and his albums were all over the place.
Jazz influences in every, even in terms of just like the harmony used, like the songwriting, even if that doesn't sound like jazz at all, no jazz instruments, it still is radically affects like the chord progressions and stuff like that. So jazz is still on everything. And there's the way jazz is probably going to progress is music that's not jazz, but as like we were talking about D'Angelo, like that's R&B, but it's all musicians on there, jazz musicians, you know. And there's a ton of other examples too.
Mm-hmm. People talk a lot about jazz influenced music. How do you view a lot of that music yourself? I know you primarily are a fan of like pure jazz, which as we talked about is just drawn such like a niche market nowadays. It may be musicians just in particular the ones consuming that, but how do you view a lot of the music that people would generally say is jazz inspired?
Generally, a lot of people when they say music is jazz inspired, I tend to not like that music, because when a lot of people say that, they mean it has like a trumpet in it or like something cheesy. Yeah. You know what I, so but, like, truly jazz-inspired music is, I mean, this is going to sound elitist, but all the best music, in any genre, it's using like jazz harmony. What's a good example? Like the rock bands Steely Dan.
Yeah.
They had a bunch of pop hits and stuff, and they were making pop music, but the reason it was so interesting is because they were using jazz chord progressions and mm-hmm. jazz harmony. Even like it could be with any song. Like most popular music is like the same four chords now, and if a song has more than that and has actually put an effort to make an interesting melody and chord progression, it is gonna look a lot more like a jazz song if you wrote it on a piece of paper than a pop song, even if it sounds like a pop song.
It's sort of ridiculous that we didn't have you bring the guitar.
I was thinking about it, but I
it wouldn't have been the best room for that, though. That's the one thing I think.
Yeah, I mean, I could have brought my acoustic.
Yeah.
That was really dumb.
We could have had to do another, a little performance, too. Can you explain how jazz borrows from, you know, earlier songs?
Yeah, well, a lot of the reason jazz still had an audience in the 40s and 50s, even though it was, by that point, really, like, intellectual music style. Like, if you look at Noun by someone like any of the people playing, like Sonny Stitt, if you look at it, would all be instrumental music, but the songs, a lot of them would be from, like, musicals from back in the 30s, popular songs that people know with lyrics. But they just use those songs as vehicles for improvisation, pretty much, and they would use the form and the chord progression of the song and improvise over that, and that's like where what the true art form was. But that's why it kept an audience for a little bit, because people would still play the melody of the song before they improvised, and people would hear that. Oh yeah, all those old songs kind of died out with like our grandparents' generation, pretty much. But there's a few examples that you would know, like Coltrane famously recorded "My Favorite Things" from The Sound of Music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm sure you know that melody.
Yeah.
People might know, like, "Summertime." That's an old Gershwin tune. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot bigger repertoire of songs that people were familiar with, and that made it kind of easier to make sense of bebop and stuff like that.
I know you're just starting to get into, you know, constructing songs your own, and, you know, it's...
Well, I mean, I've been writing music for...
Jazz music in particular, though. Is that still an approach someone like you takes? Do you look at older songs and try to draw melodies like those as, like, the basis of your songs? Or do you try to start from scratch? Because I know you talked about, like, that's becoming less and less of a thing, like, drawing from older songs.
Right, well, I mean, when I write music, I try to do something, new and yeah. interesting. Because, I mean, I understand music theory, so I could write a bunch of songs a day, but they wouldn't be, they would be glib, you know, they'd be stuff that people have already done, you know, so that's why, like, when I write something now, like, I've actually put a lot of thought into it and try to make something new. At the same time, I'm extremely influenced by every song I've ever learned, because when I'm writing a piece of music, like, I'll start in a key, I'm like, okay, the last song I wrote was in G minor, and so I had to figure out the other chords that I would go to, and so any choice I could make, whatever chord I went to, there was going to be some song that did that before me. So
mm-hmm.
you know, it's impossible to not be constantly influenced by all the music you've ever learned, even if you are creating something that's new.
Yeah, it's like writing in that sense, where you're right. almost always going to be basing it off something. Mm-hmm. Although writing, there's just, like, so many more different combinations of words you can use.
Well, not necessarily. There's a lot of different possibilities with melody and harmony and stuff like that. And that's why it's so frustrating to me that all the popular music of today has the same four chords in it. There's so much more than that. And someone did, like, a list, and they looked at, like, the top 40, and they wanted to see how many songs had this one chord progression. If it was in the key of G, it would be G, D, E minor, C. That might mean something to a couple of people listening. I don't know. Like 70% of those songs, it was that four chords. And I don't know, it's sad, because there's so much more than that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's an appetite within the popular audience for something that's a little bit more ambitious? I mean, it seems like the labels in particular push that same concept again and again just because it's so easy. I mean, their goal is to make money, so they're going to follow the formula that makes money. But if, you know, there was a particular like startup label or something that wanted to set itself apart, do you think there is an appetite out there for something that's a little bit more, you know?
I mean, there is, but it just increasingly gets smaller and smaller. Like, and it's not just jazz, it's every, like, classical. It's the other big, like, intellectual kind of music. And that's the same with jazz. Like, it's completely, now its following is musicians. It's like the same as jazz. And that was different in the last century. Like,
you feel bad about jazz dwindling. I don't hear about anybody listening to classical.
Yeah. But it's the same thing. If you look back, like, the last couple centuries, like, there was famous classical, like Mozart. I mean, that's back in the, like, 1700s. But even more recently than that, in the 20th century, there was Stravinsky. Like, he was in the 1950s, like, he was a household name. And can you name a classical or a composer of music, like, in, who's not a pop, like, act like an actual composer of music?
Like a contemporary?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no way.
Yeah, it's like, society doesn't value that anymore.
Yeah, it's a money thing, too, though. It's like with any art, like, there has to be some sort of structure for money to go towards something ambitious like that.
Yeah, musicians have historically been paid, like, terribly, except the really famous pop acts.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz and classical music losing its, like, any sort of general audience base. It's just part of a, like, a wider trend of people being unable to put any sort of effort into anything. They want everything to be immediately accessible. You know, it's the same, like, like when someone says they don't like jazz music or classical, it's like someone saying like, oh, I don't like Shakespeare. It's like, do you really not like it, or is it more likely that you haven't put in the time to the English language to understand it, which I haven't done? Like, I can't truly like understand like something like Shakespeare or like a something like that because I haven't put the time into learn and be like knowledgeable enough in that idiom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the same thing about like sophisticated forms of music.
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, it's a tricky thing because, you know, on the surface, there's people who don't like music at all. Like,
that's so bizarre to me.
There's a phenomenon where there's people who like literally can't draw any emotion from music whatsoever, or like any anything. And then below that, you'll have people who, you know, just turn on music as, like, a background thing. If they're working or something, yeah, they'll just throw it on in the background. And then, you know, there's people who listen to the radio. There's people who, you know, a pop song here or there will appeal to them. Those three groups, which I think would probably comprise, like, half of the population. Like, you can't force them to listen to music.
No, I know. Yeah.
It is a tricky thing that's going to, like, solve this.
I don't hold it against anyone. Like, it's, I just happen to be obsessed with music and practice the guitar for hours a day. You know, I can't expect everyone to have the same thing, but it is sad that, like, it's dying out, you know?
Yeah. All right. You know, I was going to bring this up. I want to talk to you about hip hop a little here because me and you, I'm such a hip hop head. It's my favorite genre. And I've tried to talk to you. I'll send you songs here or there. You just don't have an appetite for it.
I try to listen sometimes.
And I did want to get to the bottom of it a little because it does seem like even for a genre that is so definitively jazz influenced, that you have a pretty sharp distaste for it in general. And I'll give you this. There's a lot of trash in the genre. Maybe more trash in this one than any other, just because so many people want to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just think there's such a demand to get into this one in particular, because I think it's almost synonymous with pop now. You know, most of the pop you hear on the radio is hip-hop now, and they sort of go hand-in-hand, so it makes sense, because if you want to make it in the music industry, that's probably going to be one of the two lanes that you get to it through. But, you know, what bothers it about you in particular?
Well, there's a range. Like, some hip-hop is, I can enjoy. A lot is absolute trash. But the problem for me is anything with rap, and I can appreciate the lyrical, like, stuff and the flow of it, but rap, by definition, does not have a melody. Mm-hmm. It means someone speaking, not singing different pitches. And that's half of what's interesting. The unique thing about music is melody and harmony. Like, other things have words to it, you know, obviously. Books and literature and stuff like that. So that's why the lyrics are always going to be the least interesting part of the music for me. Mm-hmm. And I can still appreciate if a song has good lyrics. It can definitely touch me. And sometimes there are songs that the lyrics are the most interesting part. But the problem with anything with rap, it doesn't have a melody. And that's half the equation right there. You're just cutting out automatically.
So that is 100% true. I mean, hip-hop in particular is devoid of melody. And there was just such a perfect Q-tip quote that he threw at the audience in his documentary about A Tribe Called Quest, who I think more than anyone in the hip-hop community tried to incorporate jazz influence into their music. And he has an awesome quote in one of his songs. I can pull it up here real quick. Back in the day when I was a teenager, before I had status and before I had a pager, you could find the abstract listening to hip-hop. My pops used to say it reminded him of bebop. And you would think of hip-hop, you know, like, it has nothing in common with bebop musically. But what he saw in hip-hop and what his dad saw in it that reminded him of something like bebop is the improvisation of the words. It's devoid of melody, but in its place, the improvisation comes through the words. You know, the freestyle, the MC, that thing was like a core.
And if someone's can freestyle and make witty lines like off the top of that, I really respect it. And that's a skill I don't have, and it's amazing to me. But in terms of the product and music, if it doesn't have a melody, it makes it really hard to have a good piece of music. And I do like a lot of hip hop and rap, but that is because like the other stuff that isn't the melody is so strong that it's still an enjoyable piece of music, and it makes up for the fact that it doesn't have a melody or it only has a little bit of melody. Because I mean, a lot of rap songs, like, they'll have a little chorus where they sing a couple different notes and it's a melody. But yeah, it just makes it really hard. But there are people who can make enjoyable music that I would enjoy with just rapping. But the other pieces have to be so strong to overcome for the lack of melody.
So you'll never come across a hip hop beat that you enjoy?
No, I'm saying exactly the opposite.
Yeah,
I'm saying I do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying exactly the opposite.
The repetition and the cycling and the fact that it never really shifts bothers you.
No, not at all. I mean, all the good beats that I hear are—it's clear they're from jazz.
Yeah,
music, like all those old Jay Dilla beats.
Yeah,
like he ripped them from like he. There's a bunch from like Ahmad Jamal, one of my favorite jazz piano players. He's Herbie Hancock. All the great jazz musicians, they sample all that stuff, and the stuff that's not sampled and that's original, it is right in that style. And so I hear. That to me, it's always if a song is rap, always the most interesting part to me is the beat.
Yeah.
Because there's no melody to it, so and I can enjoy the lyrics sometime. But in terms of music, the beat is always going to be the strongest part.
Really, that's interesting.
Well, because it has no melody, and that's the beat is it has chords over it, so that's the harmony right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So that's the harmony, and then it usually doesn't have a melody because it's someone rapping, not singing, so that's half the equation, so it's always going to be the most important part. So, I mean, I hear rap beats I like all the time.
Yeah.
But most of it doesn't have a melody.
I think it is for me, too, and it's actually a different reason. Well, not an entirely different reason because you mentioned it right there, but the art of sampling, which is like the very core tenet of hip-hop. I mean, when it started in the 70s, it was, you know, 100% based on taking old records and scratching them and, you know, manipulating old songs into beats with drums and whatever other sounds they could, you know, find. I love the fact that almost always when you hear a hip-hop beat, it's going to introduce you into some older concept. Like, you know, on Jay-Z and Kanye's album 7 years ago, Watch the Throne, they sampled Strange Fruit.
Right.
On the song New Day.
And, Billie Holiday.
And, you know, you have Billie Holiday's voice, you know, cycling through the song. And, it, you know, you hear her voice, you wonder what's that from, and then it'll bring you back to an older song like that. And I think that's, like, a great way to keep, like, older music alive.
Uh-huh. Right, I mean, to me that's great if someone does that and they hear Kanye and then they say, oh, who's this? And they listen to some older music. But if I had to listen to one of those two songs, I would listen to Billie Holiday. He ripped, like, a four-bar just, like, loop from that song, but that's an entire song with a real melody and a structure to it.
Oh, and a huge and, social impact, too.
Right, but I'm just in terms of musically. Mm-hmm. To me, something like that is so much more worthwhile than someone just sampling something for four bars and having that be the entire song and just rapping over that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I've always wondered this for a long time, listening to you play and jazz musicians across the board play, because I can't get my head inside your head when it comes to, you know, the melody's coming through, you're coming up, it's time for your solo. What's going through your mind when you're starting to do some improvisation?
Well, I feel like the thing a lot of people don't understand about improvisation, good improvisation, is that I'm not just up there playing random notes. Like, I'm completely improvising something new, but everything I play is an informed choice. I know the chord progression of the song, and so I know what scales to use. I have a bunch of different scales and chords I can play over that, but they're all informed based on the song, you know? So since I have that knowledge of music theory, then I just have all these options and I could go in a bunch of different directions.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I try to be melodic and make, like, a singable melody, and other times you just want to rip through the chord changes and play some crazy lines. It all depends on the mood of the piece. You want to, when you're improvising, you want to play something that reflects the general mood of the song.
Mm-hmm. You're sort of trying to make a statement too.
Definitely.
I think.
Yep.
That's what a lot of people, I think, lose to. Even though you're not saying anything, you are trying to say something through the notes.
Absolutely. I mean, when I'm looking at when I have a solo in a song, I'm looking at the chords, the harmony, and the melody of the song, and I know that, and I'm saying, okay, like, how can I exploit this harmonic progression? Like, what other harmonies can I imply over this original harmony, or in what direction could I take the melody? And so, that's why if you listen to jazz, like, every solo on whatever song they are playing is different, because it's all catered to the song they're playing over. That's true of rock and any music that has improvised solos on it.
Mm-hmm. And when you look back at Coltrane, his Love Supreme was very devoted to, you know, how religious he was and, mm-hmm. you know, his love of God and all of that. Have you ever thought about what kind of message you want to send through your music?
I mean, when I'm writing a piece of music, I'm definitely thinking in emotion, and so I'm trying to convey a certain emotion in whatever whether I'm writing a song or improvising a solo, because they're both forms of composition.
Yep.
One is just instant, and one is takes longer. But I mean, I'm not a religious person, so I don't know if that same thing Coltrane did. But when I'm writing a song, I definitely want it to reflect not only one mood, but a bunch of different moods throughout the piece of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it would be a lot easier if I had an instrument to demonstrate that. Because that's what harmony is at the end of the day. Chords are just, to me, they're just emotions. And if you play a major chord, it's happy. If you play a minor chord, it's sad instantly.
Yeah.
You know, the whole mood changes. And that between those chords, there's one note that has been changed, but it's radically different moods.
So we're going to talk politics here, mm-hmm. as we do sometimes on the Bobcast. There's a whole political climate that we're jumping into. This fall in particular, where we're going to see the country possibly go in a new direction after just a massive rightward swing in 2016. It slowly went in that direction after 2008, and then by 2016, we were just completely thrown to the right with a Republican Senate, Republican House, and now a Republican President, who we hear about quite a bit, most recently with the Space Force. But way in the other direction, there is a leftist movement in this country, which we heard a lot from our good man Bernie Sanders in the 2016 election, who we were both very fond of. The House of Representatives candidate in the Bronx area of New York has become a new spearheading leader in this movement. But every time you hear of a surge on that end of things, people talking about socialized health care or free college tuition or whatever policies are at the forefront of this movement, there's just such a skepticism to it in this country, even though that's normalcy in other parts of the world, whether it be Europe or wherever, South America. Yeah. Why do you think in this country in particular does it go back to the communism scare that defined like a century or whatever else it is? Why do you think people are just so naturally skeptical of socialist policies in this country?
Well, yeah, when most people don't understand what socialism means or what it would mean for America, and they think of communist instantly, which it's not. There are differences, but I think, if you look at the polls, they poll people, and most people are in favor of socialist policies, Medicare, healthcare for all. I mean, like, public schools is a socialist policy, the government is a socialist policy, like, firefighters, police, people are in favor of these things, but if you ask if they're in favor of socialism, they say no.
Yeah, and they'll point to the cost, too, even though when you do look at the studies, something like healthcare in particular, we're spending so much money doing this every year because it's just so cost inefficient.
Yeah.
And if we did switch over to something like a Medicare for All, the immediate cost would be substantial, and that's what blows people away. There was a story in Vermont in particular, which Bernie goes crazy over whenever you bring it up. They were going to go towards a Medicare for All policy there, and people's taxes got boosted up 11% immediately, and that scared people so much that the governor immediately backed down on it. But if you do look at something like that, in the long term, there are cost savings to it.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the way of the future. It would be hard to implement, and that's the problem with it. But if you look at every other big country in the world, they all have a single-payer healthcare system, and it's way more cost-efficient than ours is. Ours is like one of the most expensive in the world. It's just about implementing it, and people are still scared of whenever they try to propose it.
Yeah, and a lot of people do view politics through a personal lens. You know, like, why am I paying for this? Why am I paying for that? I think that's when the term socialist gets thrown around in particular, that people really don't like it, because all of a sudden it's their tax dollars going out towards something that, you know, they may not be in favor of, or they may like, or whatever. It's an interesting discussion, because I don't know how we're going to move the perception issue that it has, even though, like, some of these changes do seem just so necessary, like healthcare in particular.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the progressive movement, like, that's, like, the only way to move forward. Like, the Democratic Party is moving in the same direction, just at a slower pace, you know? I mean, like, Obamacare, that wasn't even, like, a socialist policy. Obamacare is actually what the Republicans were proposing back in the 90s. That was the conservative plan. Yeah. But then when Obama proposed it, suddenly it was radical social nonsense, because the Republican Party just had moved so much further right in the last 10 years. But I mean, that was like an example of something moving us in the right direction. It wasn't single payer, but it was a step in the right way.
And we've talked about this before too, but the phenomenon in this country is that there, on the national stage, there really isn't a left and a right. You know, the Democratic Party in particular is very moderate, centrist, yeah. Especially since Bill Clinton.
In most other countries, our Democratic Party would be the conservative party in that country. It's like that's why people make the false equivalency between the left and the right in this country, and they say stuff like, oh yeah, the Republicans are crazy, but the Democrats are equally as crazy. No, like, Clinton was a complete moderate, and if she was running in any other big country, she would have been the conservative candidate.
And I think it showed in the primaries last time in particular. Like, the Republican side was all, you know, pretty closely aligned in what they were going to try to do, you know, slash taxes and all of that. There was it almost looked like a presidential race on the Democratic side, how fierce and intense it was and how people were holding out on the Bernie side that, like, they weren't even going to vote for Clinton. Like, it was just so intense and bitter on that side that I think that in particular should just show you how wide the gap is on the left side.
That's not the problem the left has. They're always fighting each other. The establishment people are, like, fighting the, like, progressives, the Bernie people. And we got to realize that we're both on the same side, and we got to concentrate on fighting the Republicans who are batshit crazy at this point. You know? That's why the people voted for Bernie who refused to vote for Hillary is... it's dumb.
That's something that really frustrated you. But I actually do...
Even you were talking about voting for Jill Stein at some point, I remember.
Well, I do sympathize with those people, and I actually was one of those people who had some skepticism in voting for Hillary because there's a substantial amount of policy. I know the policy difference between them versus someone like Donald Trump is a lot thinner, but at the same time...
I mean, it's not even on the same...
But at the same time... Say half of Clinton's policies aren't something that you align with, you know, whether it's trade or taxes or anything like that. It can be, you know, like, you might hop behind Clinton, but, like, you're not very enthusiastic about it candidate loses.
It's still pushing the policies in the direction that you want us to go, just at a slower pace. And the Republicans are moving it in the complete opposite direction, so it makes no sense to have a protest vote and vote right in Bernie or Jill Stein or whatever people did. How did that work out? Now we have Trump as president, and he's doing the exact opposite of what everything you wanted, except Hillary, who would have done it, everything you wanted, but just at a slower rate.
Do you think that's the reason he won? The foremost reason?
It's a reason. I don't know if it's the reason.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of reasons. People hated Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
Irrationally.
And her being a woman
plays
into that substantially. More than people want to talk about, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
With the conspiracy theories and everything else. The whole email controversy.
It was a non-issue.
It was a non-issue in the sense that two or three major politicians, including Mike Pence, the vice president, got implicated in the same kind of controversy.
It just blew over. Yeah, it was something that Fox News made a controversy to help the Republicans, but it was ridiculous. I mean, Trump had, like, all these actual scandals when he was running, like they already knew about the Russia shit in his Trump University where he was just defrauding people, and so they had to, like, make something up or just blow something completely out of proportion about Hillary to make it seem comparable, and people fell for the scam.
He became bulletproof, I think, in the sense that he embraced the scandal at every turn. He never addressed it. He never denied it. He never apologized for it.
He was the first person who figured out, if I just don't even acknowledge, if I say they're lying and refuse to apologize, they can't do anything. Every other politician... they apologize if they get any sort of public backlash. They apologize, and Trump figured out now if you just say "fuck you," pretty much, they can't do anything about it, and the news has to move on in a week.
Do you think there's going to be any precedence in the way he's carried himself through this, with how successful he's been politically? I mean, he says it himself. He could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and it just wouldn't stain his record at all. He only needs that 36% to win the presidency, which is, you know, a flaw in the system, as we can see now. But he has understood that, he's gamed it to his advantage, and he might just win another election because of it, because he knows that his antics appeal to a particular group of people, white people. And he rides that all the way. He doesn't try to appeal to the people that, you know, completely disavow of him. And we know through his approval ratings that over half the country can't stand him.
Yeah. I mean, the country is just so divided at this point. Like, no one is, like, in the middle anymore. And so it's just, it's hard seeing how we're going to move forward when we're this split.
Do you think there's substantial election reform down the line?
I don't know. It's tough to say. I wouldn't say anytime soon. I don't think we're going to get rid of the Electoral College anytime soon.
Yeah, and that really is going to become more of a conversation going forward. We've talked about election after election, especially when someone like Clinton loses the election while getting more votes. We're heading toward a population dynamic in the country, and articles have been written about this, that there's more power vested in smaller population states, and that they have, every state has two senators, every state's going to have one or two representatives, and even though, like, a state like California just has a substantial percentage of the population in the country, a place like Wyoming is going to be pretty evenly scaled when it comes out to the election numbers.
I saw this study, like, by 2040, 90% of the population is going to live in, like, the same five states.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, I don't know. I mean, something we should reform it, but I don't know. I don't think it's in the near future.
That's the tricky thing, and when it's so divided, even the seemingly simplest fixes like that, just say that the president is the person who gets the most votes, wins, almost going to be impossible to even discuss it, never mind get a resolution to it.
Right, I mean, we would have to change the Constitution, and anytime we do that...
That's the thing, when's the last time the Constitution got amended? Probably, like, the 2000s? It feels like...
I don't know exactly.
It feels like we're not even close to another one, because you think of all the states that have to approve it, and the percentages within Congress, like, the Constitution might not get amended again with the dynamic that we're in now. It's interesting times.
Yeah.
It's interesting times for sure. So, we've talked for an hour. There's so much more we could get into, but it was good to have Theo on for the first time. That's Theo Curtin. And if you're friends with me on Facebook, if you follow me on Twitter at RealBobManning, I'll try to send out some of the stuff he does, whether it's, you know, just him playing the guitar on Facebook or anything like that. We'll try to get some of his art out there for you guys to see. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's fun.
No doubt. That's the Bobcast. We'll see you next week. Good night, everyone.
So that's where I got it from, Dave.
Bobcast.